open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
You have to be really grateful and recognize that you're not better than someone who's unpublished. You're just luckier.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Emily Giffen has written 7 novels that have been described by critics as chick lit, but Giffen herself takes exception to that characterization.
I have the sense that they're saying these books are all like beach read fluff and there's nothing of substance here. I think that suggests that women or relationship driven stories lack substance, which is sexist, and I object to that.
Emily Giffen's novel, Something Borrowed, was made into a movie starring Kate Hudson and John Krasinski. Her latest novel, The One and Only, debuted on the New York Times bestseller list at number 1 for hardcover fiction. Guest host and national news editor Stephanie Murray asked Giffen what that felt like.
It's pretty thrilling. The last 5 books were all number 2. And if you're familiar at all with football, my husband made the comment that I was the Buffalo Bills of writers. And somehow I mentioned it in an interview, and then the New York Times picked it up, and then they called me the Buffalo Bills of writers. So it's a great feeling. It's really thrilling.
Well, that nickname will go away now.
I kind of liked it, though. He even gave me a Buffalo Bills t-shirt for Christmas last year.
Well, tell us a little bit about the book. Tell us about The One and Only. What's the storyline?
Sure. I've always found that it's a little boring to delve too much into the fiction when you haven't read the book, so I'll be very brief. But I really wanted to explore the idea of unconventional love. Mm-hmm. I think so often we expect our lives and our relationships to look and be a certain way, and I was really inspired by the question, you know, what if what you want isn't right on paper? Or what if you fell in love with the one person you shouldn't? Mm-hmm. And beyond that, a little more specifically, it features a 34-year-old Shay who lives in a small football-obsessed town in Texas. And she's her life is one of, you know, her relationship feels good enough and her job feels safe. Mm-hmm. And there's this moment, that happens in the first chapter of the book where she asks herself, if I'm really living the life I'm meant to be living, am I meeting my destiny? And I think that's another question that we all ask ourselves at various points for various reasons. And mm-hmm. that inspired the book.
And it seems like it's something you probably asked yourself when you were in London, right? It was London when you made the decision to start writing?
Well, it was, I used to be a lawyer, so I discovered that misery is very motivating. I think sometimes it's almost that when things are just good enough that it's more dangerous terrain. I was just completely miserable practicing mm-hmm. law, but when I left the University of Virginia, I had $100,000 worth of debt, so mm-hmm. I didn't have much choice but to practice for a little while until I paid that back. But there was definitely, for me, that's a theme that I've visited several times mm-hmm. within several books, mm-hmm. but that feeling of really needing to take a risk and take that leap of faith and just follow your instinct that, mm-hmm. That get on your path. And that's definitely what I did when I left my law firm and I was practicing in New York City and I moved to London mm-hmm. where I wrote Something Borrowed.
That's what I'm thinking.
So, right, close enough.
Yeah. But, so what took you from New York City to London?
Well, if I had been truly brave, I would have gone to Italy and written Eat, Pray, Love, right?
There you go.
but I love that book.
It's a great book.
So, I always wanted to live abroad and mm-hmm. and have that experience. I was 29, and at the time I thought that 30 was just such a scary benchmark, which is ludicrous. But I was leaving the law. I was sort of ending a relationship that wasn't working for me. I was mm-hmm. really, I'd written, it sounds very romantic and, charmed. Oh, I moved to London. I wrote Something Borrowed. It was published. It's all, I never looked back, but mm-hmm. the piece that's missing from that is that I had been writing really my whole life mm-hmm. and then had written a whole novel while I was practicing law and paying mm-hmm. back my loans. So at night, and sometimes when I was billing General Electric, it's a flat rate, so I don't feel that guilty, but I still remember the client and billing number was 80020 matter one. It's really, it's been 12 years since I've been there, but... So, What was your question again? Oh, why?
I don't
remember. Why London?
Now.
Why London?
Why
so.
London? Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, that was just, that felt, that was a, out of my, huge push for me.
Yeah.
But I wasn't quite brave enough to do, you know, to France or Italy or somewhere.
Yeah.
You
know. One more question about this book, and then I have so many questions for you just about being a writer and the process and your characters and everything. In the intro to this from Random House, Jennifer Hershey says that every time you outdo yourself, and she calls this your best book yet. Do you agree with that?
Well, one of the things that really motivates me as a writer is to always, you know, continue to evolve and tell a more substantive story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the characters, when I wrote Something Borrowed, I was 29 and, you know, I was, I'm not going to say immature, but a typical, you know, 29-year-old. And I feel like I've, you know, now I got married, I've had three children, you know, I have this change in careers. And so I continue to try to write a deeper story and a more layered story. And one of the things that really does, you know, motivate me not only sort of internally and to tell a better story is I never want my you know, very loyal readers to say, you know, I liked her old stuff better. I mean, we've all said that about, you know, musicians or,
sure.
or authors, like, oh, I liked her first few books, but that strikes fear in my heart. So, I mean, it's always going to be a book that is your favorite. But I like to think that I keep, you know, telling stories that are, you know, as good or better than the one before it.
Keep getting better,
So that was.
And so your books are about relationships. They're about the deep complexities in so many and relationships in different parts of people's lives. And I wonder how much of yourself ends up in the books and how much of your surroundings and your environment.
Right.
You know, where do you draw inspiration for those stories from?
Well, I do write books that are very relationship-driven and relationship-rich. I write about mothers and daughters and husbands and wives and, you know, friendships, female friendships, male-female friendships. So because I'm writing in that terrain, of course you draw naturally on, you know, your own relationships. And beyond that, I think as people, particularly as women, we often discuss and analyze relationships of friends of friends. So you talk to your best friend and then you say, well, how's Laura doing? And what's the latest with your sister? And so there's so much terrain to work with. As far as, you know, how much I share with my protagonist, I've now written, this is my seventh book, and I've written in the first person, save for Heart of the Matter, which with alternating perspectives between first and third, two women.
Oh yeah, I didn't realize that.
So this is, right, so just to sort of distinguish the voices, I did first, third, so it didn't, you know, sometimes it can be confusing when you change voices, but.
Yeah.
So if you consider that, that's eight women, and I think that for me to effectively tell a story, I have to connect to my protagonist in one significant way. So I don't feel like I've never written any book that's truly autobiographical or, you know, the plots are not something that have, none of them are familiar in my life, like as far as the actual plot, but feeling like I can relate to a character, whether it's, you know, a similar job. In the first book, she was a lawyer, or, you know, in this book, Shay, my main character, she's 34, not married, no children. I obviously have a very different life, but we're both very passionate about, you know, college sports and athletics, and so I could really relate to her with that. And I really didn't think about that as I was writing it, but my best friend from high school, who he's a writer out in LA, called me after he read the advance copy and said, this is the first time I felt like she's so similar to you. And I thought, no, she's not. She's not married. She's not this. She's 10 years younger. But I can see, after I thought about it, I really did feel a connection to her voice. So.
And if you haven't read The One and Only yet, there are a lot of really amazing football references in that book. And I wondered, as I was reading it, how much research did you do for this?
Yeah.
Did you just know all this stuff off the top of your head as you were writing? And then I read somewhere that you're specifically a college basketball
nut,
in addition to Brady Bunch.
Yeah,
right?
Brady Bunch. I got stumped, by the way, on the Chicago News. I got to get
did
that
you?
Off my website because people will quiz me on the, you know, on the news. They showed a clip and I'm like, come on, I'm nervous, I'm on TV. And then I was like, Doug Simpson. But, you know, college sports, first of all, I should say that this is the backdrop of the book, but it's still, you know, and it felt like a risk in some ways, you know, when my editor said, do you think that your core demographic won't relate to this? And I think First of all, I think women love sports just as much as men in many cases. But also, you know, my analogy is I love the Rocky movies, but I don't like boxing. I never watch boxing. But for me, my background was a basketball manager at Wake Forest. I grew up very passionate about college basketball and wanted to be a manager of a major program. Tim Duncan was at Wake, and he's playing tonight. So that's my last vestige of youth, that someone that I handed towel and water to is still playing in the finals. But so that was, you know, I changed it to football because I felt like it was more, you know, football and Texas, it just felt like, you know,
they went
sort
together.
Of bigger, more colorful, perhaps, than college basketball, more universally relatable.
Yeah.
But I think that world really worked well for some of the themes in this book, particularly the idea of loyalty, because one of the things that was so, that I noticed so much about my experience as a manager is this team was like a family. And, you know, we were incredibly loyal to one another, and very diverse backgrounds, but you come together with this common goal, and I think that really those themes really worked for this story. But it could have been set really the same relationship dynamics could have been set in a variety of, it didn't need to be football.
Sure.
As far as research, I just realized I didn't answer your question.
How did you get all that information?
I mean, I know enough about football that it wasn't. You know, it in places I would ask. You know, my husband, he knows more, and a couple other friends knew more, but. For those of you, I promise this talk won't be about college football, but if you know Pat Dye of Pat Dye Stadium, you know, Auburn, he read an advance copy, so did Coach Boeheim, and they both blurbed it, but Coach Dye called me on the phone and said, "I want to know how a Yankee from Chicago knows so much about football." I was like, oh, yes, that's the ultimate compliment. So, but don't be turned off if you don't like football, because it really, you know, it's not...
No.
It's not that.
It's definitely not. No, the book
is not.
A little
flavor here and there.
Yes, yes, so. For sure. It's a backdrop, absolutely. So I think there are probably a lot of writers in the audience. This is a literary crowd we have here.
I wish I could see the literary
crowd. I know.
Crowd.
I was saying,
but
I
when
can't
it's Q&A and
yes.
the lights come on, I'll be able to
and
see
we'll
you.
Be able to see.
And then
out
I brought
there.
My camera because I want to take a picture of you all. But anyway.
You worry about that. You're like, is
I'm
okay
worried.
To bring
I'm like,
my
I need
camera?
My camera
like,
under
it's
there.
Fine.
That's like big. Yeah.
The audience will love it. Yeah. How do you, what's the process for you when you're writing and you're developing a story? Do you start off by knowing in general the outline of where you want to take it? Or is it just a process where you just start writing? Do you have characters develop? What's that like?
Well, for me, maybe it's a reaction to being a lawyer and practicing law and having to just outline everything. And you know when you write a brief or a legal memorandum exactly what you have to do. And so I think in the early stages, it was so refreshing to me when I was writing Something Borrowed and living in London to just sort of, let's see where the story takes me. And then I vowed after that that I would start outlining because it's, you know, it's inefficient to write that way. But I've never been able to do that. So this is the seventh book that's been published, eight including the one that was rejected. And I've never outlined. So what I usually come up with a premise that inspires me. What if you love the one you're with? What if you run? Everyone has this one who got away. What happens if you run into that person and sort of have a second chance? Like, you know, baby proof. I don't need to give you example.
Sure.
You get the drift.
Yep.
But the premise comes first, then the characters, and then the characters form these relationships, and then it drives the plot in a very, you know, organic way. What I've said before is that, you know, creating characters is like meeting a new friend. You know, we met a little while ago, and we talked, and we just had, you know, coffee and tea, and, you know, I learned that you're, you know, moving to Nashville, or your husband is, and, you know, the more you tell me, the more that I understand you, and, you know, your background, and as you get to know someone, you know more what they would do in a situation. So what I think my characters will do in the beginning is often not what they end up doing, and I really try to be true to who they are and to their relationships. And as the relationships form, of course, that can take you in varied ways too. But I usually do have a beginning, middle, and end in mind, but it almost never follows that. It didn't in this book either. The only book, and I think maybe that's why I mentioned Love the One You're With, was that's the only one where I could not figure out what she was going to do. Maybe it's just I had a baby and I was like, but I couldn't get in her. It could have gone both ways.
Yeah, yeah.
So
when you're writing and you have a beginning and a middle of end laid out in your mm-hmm. mind, how much when you're writing do you go back and say, oh, I don't want that, or oh, that's not right, and do you kind of second guess as you're writing, or is it really just a free flow and you keep going?
Well, this isn't exactly what you're asking, but yeah. as far as like the writing process goes, I'm a huge reviser.
You
I revise
are.
And okay. revise and revise and revise, mm-hmm. and I think that's, you know, for me anyway, what really elevates a book, you know. So I start every day of writing, revising what I wrote the day before. And that also makes me feel better about those very unproductive days where you don't have the word count and the, you know, outputs. Just, oh, well, at least I revised this and made it better from the day before. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the first thing that springs to mind with that question. And what was your question again? I was so thrown off my game with that missed flight. It said boarding time 8:05, and I could have sworn it said 8:50. So I'm two gates down signing books at a newsstand, yucking it up with the person selling books and taking photos for, I couldn't believe that.
But I love the fact that you were walking through the airport and you, like you said earlier, you're not going to walk by your own books and not sign them. Which is great.
I think it has a little more to do with OCD. I mean, I really should sign that book. It's my matching teal Sharpie.
Yes.
But,
only the teal Sharpie for the one and only.
Yes, my daughter, she's 6 years old. She's in the first grade, but she was just diagnosed with mild dyslexia. And, we got the report, and we're sitting there and, you know, discussing the plan for next year. And I said to my husband, I'm a best-selling author. She didn't get this from me. Because the therapist said, oh, it's usually very hereditary. So when I told him today, he's like, how'd that happen? I said, I thought it said 8:50 and it said 8:05. And he goes, he's like, oh, yeah, you're not dyslexic or anything. Like, shoot.
And so, you know, that's Harriet.
Harriet,
and
right.
she's seven.
She just turned seven. Yeah.
And so you mentioned to me earlier the story about how she's seven and she made an observation about.
Right. So she credited herself with the number one debut because it was my seventh book and she turned seven.
Yeah.
And then she said, maybe you'll be eight. No, wait. Like she recognized that that wasn't. I'm
that's
like, I don't write
good.
A book a year. Yeah. And then when I told her, you know, they were on speaker and you said the book was number one and everyone was excited. You know, they were all happy about that. She said, if you're joking, this isn't very funny. No, Harriet, that wouldn't be very funny.
What is the life of an author like, of a best-selling author? I mean, you've had great commercial success. Dozens of folks, hundreds of folks will come out to your book signings and to meet you. And what is life like today for you?
I mean, I think my life is very typical of any, you know, working mother. Mm-hmm. It's very unglamorous. I mean, you know, this is another Harriet story, but I was, you know, there was a picture that was a photograph that was in Atlanta magazine. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, Harriet, I'm in Atlanta. And she opened it and she said, that's not you. And I said, yes, it's me. I'm like, look, and she looks at it. She goes closer, she closes the magazine, throws it on the table, she goes, well, it doesn't look like you. So, I mean, it's just, you get your kids off to school, you're just trying to, I feel so lucky, you know, that to have had this, you know, to be even be published and to be read. I mean, I feel very lucky, but it's, you're constantly just writing, trying to make a deadline, revise the book, get it turned in, you know, and then it's time to get ready for a tour, and then, of course, in the back of my mind, I know that as soon as I get back from the tour, it's time to write the next book. And I'm a slow writer. I mean,
are you?
Well, I mean, I guess slow? In the scheme of things, maybe in between. But a lot of commercial writers will put out a book a year, and that's just it's impossible for me. I did 04, 05, 06, and then I just said I can't do this anymore. Like you miss the whole summer with your children because you're on tour. And I just didn't think, kind of referencing back to my earlier answer about wanting to always, you know, continue to write a book that was as good or better than the one before it. I just didn't feel that I could keep that level of, you know, quality and really, you know, be proud of what I was putting out and keep readers and cultivate new ones
yeah.
with that pace. I feel slow compared to a lot yeah. of my peers who are writing.
What is your pace normally? Like if you spend
I write
it
about 15 months it takes me to write a book.
Okay.
But then the revising is several months more, mm-hmm. and then you're getting ready for a tour. And to really be, you know, effective, I think at that, you have to sort of take off the writing hat and then mm-hmm. really put on, you know, the marketing, and mm-hmm. especially now with all the social media and all the things you can be doing. Yeah. And that to me is, I enjoy parts of it, and I don't like other mm-hmm. parts of it, but I like the connection with readers.
Yeah.
I like going on tour and talking to the people who are reading the books mm-hmm. because it can be so solitary.
Yeah.
So to have that connection, I think, is exciting. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. But.
And speaking of social media, you are really good and active on social media. If you don't already follow Emily, she's active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you do a really yeah. great job.
Well, thanks.
And do you do that all yourself, or do you have
yeah.
folks who help you post? And
no, I do it myself, and sometimes I think I use it to procrastinate because I'm like, well, social media is very important, so let me post a picture of the cupcake, you know that.
You're working.
Yeah.
You're working,
yes, yeah. It's like really yeah. hard. But you know, I'd also rather do a load of laundry than write half the time. So,
yeah.
you know, it's. I think that's how. That's the curse of, the writers
being
out there.
A writer.
How many of you are writers? I can sort of see.
Yeah,
well,
we've got yeah. some writers. Yeah.
So I mean, it's. I can revise a thank you note, you know, five times. You know, go through five. Yeah, but so.
Yeah, so you yeah. do all that posting yourself.
I do.
Yeah,
do
you like it?
Yes.
It's work, but it's also engaging with the folks who are
yes,
some
I think
of your
it,
best
it
audience.
Yes, I think it does feel, you know, I'm a little bit of, I'm an introvert. I'm a sort of a closet introvert. I feel like I've learned to fake it very well over the years. So that's a way of interacting,
yeah.
in a limited sort of way where you can yep. still be in your pajamas or, you know, in your sweats, and you can kind of interact with people. So I think I enjoy it. And I think you can tell mm-hmm. when someone enjoys it versus when someone's doing it for, you can
yes.
sort of tell the people who are.
Yeah. I think that comes else. Through in your social media that you do enjoy and you like talking to your fans. I mean, that you do, you
yeah.
respond and.
I try, I mean, yeah. I try to. It is. It's gratifying to also hear very directly, you know, when I wrote my first mm-hmm. few books, there just wasn't any of that. I mean, there was mm-hmm. MySpace, but
yeah,
you know, so it's really gratifying to be able to connect and hear so immediately what people think. And it really, you know, I've said this before to them, to readers, but it really helps you get through writer's block. When someone's saying, I can't wait, like, oh my gosh, I'm counting down the days until your next book, you think, mm-hmm. okay, like, someone's excited to read this. And
yeah, it's a motivation.
So, yeah, mm-hmm. it is for me, yeah. it is.
Does your publisher tell you, like, give you advice on how active to be with social media or in other forms of marketing yourself? Like, how much do they give you guidance?
Well, you know, with the leading up to the book tour, they'd have like, you know, can you tweet? Can you post something about this or something about that? And can you do a video thing?
Okay.
And I actually called them at one point, and Random House is amazing. They are so professional and good and on top of it and wonderful to work with. But at some point, I think, you know, I just mentioned to my publicist, like, when it's script, when you're telling me that I need to post this, it doesn't feel right. It has to be more,
yep.
I'm not going to
organic.
Say organic with the, well, I mean, that sounds
does,
like,
yeah.
come on.
It
mean,
sounds like a farm to me.
But. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's a post. It can't
yeah.
be that organic.
Authentic.
But yeah, authentic is a better word.
Yeah.
That's a good word,
yep.
yes.
Yeah.
So you're a good editor.
Yes. Hopefully.
Yes.
I just got this job.
Editor-in-chief. Editor-in-chief. That's
12
that's
weeks.
Huge.
12
that's
weeks.
Huge.
As someone asked me the other day, they're like, you know, what's going to happen in a year from now and this and that? We're planning. I hope I still have a job.
No,
I mean,
you're
just
gonna
got
be great.
Here. So
you're gonna be
great. We'll see. We'll
it's
see.
Exciting.
So you mentioned earlier, you said something about luck. And when we were having tea downstairs at Brew, we talked a little bit about the luck involved in getting published. And I hope you could talk a little bit
yeah,
more about
sure,
that for,
sure.
for this group.
Well, you know, I do think it's sort of like signing the books as I pass a newsstand. Like, I feel like one of my greatest attributes is that I'm extremely hardworking. And and I've always been that way. My publisher said to me, like, you're the hardest working author. And so I take that as such a compliment. And that's a very important part of, I think, my success. But I think that you have to work hard to create a lucky break for yourself. So you can't overlook the component of luck.
Yeah.
And, you know, I worked very hard. I wrote this book when I was practicing law, and then I quit, and then I went, and I had a self-imposed deadline, and I will finish this book in a year, and I did. And so, of course, that was all. But at the end of the day, it still required the huge, enormous, you know, luck of having someone say, we're going to buy this. And we were talking, and I'd like to try to insert this into all my talks when there are any writers in the group, but there's such a thin line between, you know, being unpublished and you know, having millions of, you know, being number one on the, such a thin line. And you can't, you know, when I submitted that manuscript, I had an agent who said to me, the very first manuscript, she said, this isn't, you know, you'd have to change it in all these significant ways for me to even represent it. And my husband, then boyfriend, said, you got to play ball with her and change it. And I said, I'm just not feeling these changes. So then I submitted it, and it's, you know, it's sold millions of copies. It's in 35 languages. And the thing that's so important to remember is you had one agent who said, you know, I don't like this book this way. You have to change it. And then I had someone who bought it exactly as is. And it doesn't make the one person wrong and the other person right. It's just such a matter of taste. It's such a, you know, the is this too long-winded of an answer?
No. Yeah, okay. Not at all. No, this is great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just
you're getting to the good part.
Okay. So when I was writing in the beginning, before I was in the world of publishing, you know, the insider world, I used to think that, like, if you submit a manuscript to Random House, that meant that there was at least 20 people reading your book, and then they all would have, like, this little book club in a conference room, and they would say, can we sell this book, and do you think she's a good writer, and do we see potential there? When really, it goes from your agent to one editor. So my agent picking a certain editor to send it to, like, knowing that person and thinking, okay, she'll connect with this work, is, you know, what if she had just bought a very similar book to Something Borrowed the week before? Or what if she had been in a really bad, you know, breakup and she didn't want to hear about...
She personally just didn't connect with the story.
Yeah, or what if she just didn't like it? Yeah. So that's one bite of the Random House apple. So once they say, once that one editor says no, you get this rejection letter. And then if you get eight of those, that means that eight people said no to your book. But that's not what you imagine as an unpublished writer, of like this universal rejection from all of New York City. You know, it's just it's eight individual people. And so I think it's just important to remember that on the unpublished side of writing, to keep your faith, if your goal is, I mean, there's plenty of writers who don't want to publish. Yeah. And they're just as much of a writer as a published, you know, writer is. So I think it's important to remember on that side. And I think it's equally important to remember on this side that, you know, you have to be, you know, you have to be really grateful and recognize that you're not better than someone who's unpublished. You're just luckier.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
That's my two cents on
luck. That makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of people hoping that they hit that one editor and get lucky and get that manuscript landed. So you mentioned that there was that the first manuscript got rejected.
Right.
What happened to that?
Oh, I still have it somewhere. It's not very good.
Oh, I don't know if we all believe that.
But that's my agent, my bad agent story.
Okay.
She, not that she's the reason that it wasn't published, but she was finally, it's on my website, I think, actually, because like inspiration to unpublished writers. But I couldn't get her to even answer my question about the submissions. Like, you know, and I shouldn't mention her name, but it's Jody Rhodes. But she's out in the West Coast, Jody Rhodes. But she would not tell me, like, a simple, like, status report. And finally, I said, you know, Happy New Year, Jody, and I'd just really like to circle back. I recognize that there's not, you know, good news, but I would really like closure on this manuscript.
Sure.
And she wrote back, they all rejected it. Like, that's all they all rejected it. I'm like, oh, that's like no bedside manner there at all.
How did you find her in the first place?
I mean, it was just, I sent it to, like, you know, eight, just one of those
books.
Okay. So, and I sent it out to a few agents, and she, you know, wanted to represent it. I think she probably deals with a large volume. I really shouldn't diss her, but it's Jody Rhodes.
You know, the West Coast.
My sister mentions her every now and then. She's like, do you think Jody knows? And I'm like, honestly, I don't think she does, because I think she probably signs a lot of clients and, you know, but...
Yeah. Until the one day when she shows up in the audience.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm Jody Rhodes. Hi,
that would
Emily.
Be bad, wouldn't it?
That would be bad.
I talk a big game under the bright lights when I can't see anybody.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Emily Giffen talks more about her writing process and her advice to aspiring writers.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The National Writer Series is a year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in downtown Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Stephanie Murray's conversation with best-selling novelist Emily Giffen.
So you also mentioned a couple minutes ago a part on your website where you give advice to inspiring writers. So what is some of your best advice for folks who are trying to make it or who are writing and maybe they haven't published yet, they want to be published or they've got that first book published?
Well, I would say
what's that like?
The whole, you know, my answer to the whole question
Lucky.
About, yeah, just mm-hmm. just that you have to recognize that you can't have your whole path defined by a few people's opinion of your work. You have mm-hmm. to just keep after it. I think also, you know, read a lot, keep writing. You know, I think even the very best writers I've heard don't feel like writing. It's like working out. I mean, sometimes you really don't want to do either, and you just sort of have to put in the time and write.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important. And I think, you know, if your goal is to be published, you can't have that in your head all the time, like, will this sell and will this, you still have to really tell a story you want to tell. And that's something that I try to keep in mind with every book. You know, I try to, you know, not, if I'm not excited about the story, then no one else will be. And the same, you know, the movie side of things, I'm often asked, like, do you write with, you know, with a movie in mind, and it's, you know, absolutely not. Perhaps I should, you know, if I were being commercially more savvy, but I can't, I don't want to be that, you know, strategic with writing fiction. I feel like you have to have this deep connection to your story and your characters, so.
When do you write?
You know, I have to be a little more scheduled because of having children. But really, so I try to write, you know, when they're in school. But it's really, sometimes I write in the middle of the night. Sometimes really early in the morning is a very quiet time. But because I'm slow, I really have to put in a very full 50 hours a week of work. Of some, you know, the breakdown varies with the cycle of the publishing. But I work 40 to 50 hours a week, and that's not when, getting the manuscript in. Then it's probably more when it's like close to a deadline.
Sure, sure. Do you go to do you have an office specifically that you go to, or do you have an office at home, or where do you go to write?
One of the reasons that we lived in one home in Atlanta, and then we moved. And one of the reasons that we chose this house is because it has like this little pool house in the back. You know, really small in a loft-like area, and so I'm able to write there. It's detached from the house because you can't really. I mean, with the three children, it's when they come home from school, like everything stops if you're not out there. But I also find that in the life of every book, I need to have at least two significant trips, like four or five nights away.
Oh, okay.
Because even when you're home, like to really get in the groove of fiction, I think you need you know, like 10 hours of quiet versus just like the six. So it's very helpful to me. I love writing in really like loud spaces too, which I think is unusual. Like airports are great. Today would have been great.
I was gonna say this morning.
Why
you missed your flight.
I was too distraught today to write. I'm like, I'm such a loser. Like, I found out last night that I'm number one, and then I missed my flight. It was such a rookie move. And I said to my publicist, I was not drinking last night. I was out with my 11-year-old nephews and my sister. I just transposed the numbers, so.
Gosh,
I'm
that's
just
so
glad.
Exciting.
I'm just glad I got here.
For
I'm
you
just
to
so
be
glad.
Number one, too. I mean, that's just it's, such
it's
awesome
fun,
news.
I'm just
I love
glad.
That.
I'm glad I'm here. This is the coolest. Are all of you from here? A lot of you from here?
Yeah.
It's the. I was blown away.
It's beautiful.
I mean, I grew up in Chicago. I went to high school in Chicago, so you know, I had friends who vacationed here, and but it's just so exceeded even my expectations of how charming and.
And the weather was beautiful
it's,
today.
Oh, it's perfect.
Sunny
yes,
and
if only
warm.
I had more hours here, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know you have to leave so early tomorrow morning, or else we'd.
3:30 wake up call.
Yeah.
So that's the hard part about a book tour. Isn't so much the engagements, the events. It's the that you have to be TV ready the next morning for the next. So I fly to St. Louis and have to.
So you're gonna get up at like 3 a.m. and have to get TV ready.
Right.
To go get on the
plane. Look like someone, a version of myself that my daughter doesn't recognize.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
There you go. So you mentioned that when you're writing, you have a spot, you know, separate from the home, and then you go out and spend several nights away. Do you ever go to a location and scout it out as a setting?
I did. That's a good question.
Okay.
Yeah. For most of my books, I haven't needed to. For some, this one set in Texas, you know, a fictional
I was
small
wondering
town,
if, yeah.
But it's Texas, and I don't know Texas very well, other than you know books and movies. And you know, occasional trips on book tours and so forth. But so I went down there. I spent some time. I went to SMU to their spring practices, and you know, spent some time with the team and ate a lot of guacamole and drank some margaritas. And told my husband it was very hard work.
It was
life of a writer, very stressful. Had another margarita. So. Yeah, but Dallas is, Texas in general, it's just so, there's so much color. So it was really, it was a fun place to go.
Did you tell the folks at SMU that you were researching for a book when you were there?
I did.
Was
it
okay?
Yes, I told them. I'm sure they thought, you know.
I wonder if they're reading it now, looking for.
Well, I sent them copies, so hopefully, you know, they'll take a look. It helps to be endorsed by some of these, you know, names in sports. So it gives you a little more credibility as they decide whether to read it. But But yeah, I'm grateful to them. They were very kind about letting me hang out and just observe.
Yeah,
so it was fun.
We talked a couple minutes ago too about movies, and one of your books, of course, was made into a great movie, one of my favorites.
Oh, thank you.
What's going on with your other books and movies? Is that I think I've read somewhere that that some of the rights have been optioned. Are there going to be other movies based on other Emily Giffen books?
Well, the first two books were related, so it's Something Borrowed and then Something Blue was the sequel. And so the movie, yes, the second movie is being made.
Oh, exciting.
Yes. We didn't talk about that.
We didn't talk
before.
About that yet.
Yeah.
No, that's
so,
awesome.
And I'm writing the script, which I'm thrilled about.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sure it'll be rewritten, but I get the first crack at it. And
did you get the first crack at the script on Something Borrowed?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. The producers of Something Borrowed, Hilary Swank and Molly Smith. Molly was in Atlanta filming The Blind Side, and so she called me and right after she read, you know, something. She bought the rights to Something Borrowed. We met. And she, now we're very, very close friends. But she, we joke that she was warned, don't get too chummy with the authors, they're all crazy. And I was warned, you'll hate the movie. Like, you're gonna hate the movie, so just prepare yourself.
That's what people always say.
And so we were both sort of told this, but I was very careful, and I knew it was by invitation only that they were involving me. So I was always very careful not to overstep, not to think this is my book, and how dare you change it. So it was very much like, you know, I would wait, and when they asked my opinion, I gave it, but I was always very respectful.
I didn't realize it was that separate.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I said, this is what I think. Not until the end, there was a couple little things where I was like, come on, Molly, like, don't, like, this should be, you know, but that was more because we were really good friends at that point. And so, because we all worked so well together, you know, the producers and the director and I, we formed these really great friendships and great working relationships. It's because I think the movie did, you know, well enough, and you know, maybe I'm in a slightly different point in my publishing career, so now I have more, you know, say in things, you know, But again, I'm not just saying this to them, I mean it. It's mm-hmm. their world. I love writing fiction. Mm-hmm. I will always be a novelist, no matter. I don't want this career. I don't want to move to LA. I don't want to write for television. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, you know, focus on movies.
Sure.
So this is really fun to be able to write the first draft to something blue, but mm-hmm. I'm sure it'll be rewritten, and that's fine.
What is that like, writing the script based off the book that you've already written? I mean,
I never would have been able to do it with something borrowed, but because I was so involved in watching it and in working with the screenwriters and listening, I really learned so much about it. And so now mm-hmm. I feel like I can write, a decent first draft. But mm-hmm. I flew out to LA in February, and we sat in this big conference room with index cards, and we laid out, you know, the three acts. I mean, I guess everyone knows about, like, that all movies are pretty much three acts. And mm-hmm. I wasn't aware that it could be broken down like that, but,
so you did that together.
We did that. We did, we like, beat by beat, every scene, you know, of all three acts, we sort of got this mm-hmm. outline. So I'm working from that, but then writing it within that. Mm-hmm. And I feel really lucky that they're giving me this chance.
Absolutely,
I do feel like I still know the characters the best. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, the actors and John Krasinski. Do you all know him from mm-hmm. the Office? And he'll play the lead in the second one.
Oh, okay.
And so he saw that I tweeted, I'm finally going out and working on the script.
Yeah.
And he's very good friends with Molly, and so instantly texted her and said, "Is Emily coming out there? And why didn't you tell me that the script was being written? And I want to be involved." And she's like, "He's so pushy." She loves John, but she was like, "He can look at it when we're good and ready to show him." And I'm like, "Well, don't you think he would be really?" And she's like, "No, every actor just wants to make sure that their part's the best." And like, it's like, okay, whatever, it's your world.
What a world.
It
what
is.
What a world
it's,
you're in.
I mean, it's, don't
I love
get
you
me
just
wrong.
Use Hilary
it's,
Swank.
It's,
like,
yeah,
earlier,
yeah,
like,
no,
in
I
passing.
Mean, it's
that's awesome.
It's thrilling, it's so fun.
Yeah.
But it's fun, you know, just snippets here and there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so far from my real, like, life and what I want my real life to be.
Sure,
so.
Sure. One more question about that. Do you think that the script would be pretty close to the book, or do you think that you'll take some liberties?
For something the one that I'm writing?
Yeah,
there's a
writing.
Couple of changes.
Okay.
Yes,
that you worked out when you
said. But I feel
the
like
acts.
If I'm comfortable with them, then hopefully the readers will be comfortable with them too.
Yeah.
It just kind of works better.
Yeah.
I should also mention that Love the One You're With is being made too.
I was just going to ask. Okay,
so that's
kind
of happening, which is exciting. But you never know with that world. You know,
sure.
It's until it's really fully greenlit and, mm-hmm. you know, you just never know what can happen.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, what will eventually come out of it. Changing gears a little bit.
Sure.
When you Google Emily Giffen, one of the things that comes up in the description of your novels is chick lit.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit about this
we
earlier.
Did.
I'd like to know how do you describe the novels that you've written and your stories, the stories that you tell, and what do you have to say about that being dubbed chick lit?
Yeah, I could talk. I could give a whole talk on this. You know, I think of what I write is generally as women's fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of how it's dubbed. Although I do think this is the first book that I've written that men will really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that men don't read fiction as much as it's like 80%
oh, really?
Of all novels
that's
are
statistic.
Bought by, you know, and then men read more nonfiction, but there's exceptions to that. But the chick lit, you know, the chick lit, it's a tough one to answer because I think it's really more of a marketing label, and I think it's a function of when I first published. So when I wrote Something Borrowed, the mm-hmm. title, the working title of the manuscript was called Rolling the Dice. There's a scene where she rolls the dice, and this question of like fate versus, you know, how you control your own destiny. And the book really ends in with a little bit of a bittersweet note and a melancholic ending. And so it's not your typical, you know, if it were made into, well, it was made into a movie, wasn't it?
If it were made into a movie.
But it's not like the typical, I mean, one of the things that was difficult to sell is like the protagonist is doing such an unlikable, unsympathetic thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little different from your, you know. So, in other words, I think what happened was it was the explosion of this genre called chick lit with Bridget Jones' Diary.
Mm-hmm.
I was publishing then. My editor called and said, "We want Rolling the Dice isn't going to work for us as a title. That sounds like a guy book about gambling. We need something girly." And I'm like, okay, girly. And I just kept thinking My Best Friend's Wedding, which of course was Taken. And it's finally, you know, I'm like trying to write down wedding things. And it's not really about a wedding. It's about a troubled female friendship. Mm-hmm. And finally we came up with Something Borrowed. And then the cover came back and it was pink and it had a sparkly diamond ring on it. And, you know, I didn't object to any of that because I didn't think in terms of marketing. I didn't think, I just wrote this book. Mm-hmm. And then I trusted these experts to say, okay, this is what, we're gonna package it and this is how it's going to sell. And you know what, they were right. Mm-hmm. Because it did sell. It was, the first book made the bestseller list, which has everything to do with marketing and very little to do, no one knew me. So they were right. And I think what's happened is I've grown up and my stories have changed, and really there's no hallmark of chick lit, you know, if you consider, other than first person, which is lots of people write in the first person, but, you know, my characters aren't shoe shopping, they're not drinking martinis, they're not, you know, I don't feel like they're, and not that there's anything wrong with the books where that happens, but it's really not what I do. And so sometimes it's frustrating to constantly hear that label, because I feel like a lot of people, you know, women, men, people of all ages who would connect with my readers and the complex relationships, you know, that I, the things that I like to write about might not pick it up because of the sparkly ring on the front.
Yeah.
And it's because I don't pick up books. If there's like a, you know, a lipstick on the, or a shoe, I'm not drawn to that, book. And so, I think that's one of the reasons that when I moved to Random House, we did change the covers because they looked a little bit girly. They looked a little bit young. They looked a little bit chick lit. But all that said, I don't get offended by that. And, you know, I feel like I just want the readers who will enjoy my books to find them. And however that happens, you know, I think is great. The only thing about the chick lit label, I think when it's used to just sort of describe stories about women, for women, you know, women who are dealing with relationships and whether they're buying shoes or drinking martinis or not, you know, I think that that label's okay. But when I have the sense that they're saying, you know, these books are all like beach read fluff and there's nothing of substance here, I think that suggests that that women or relationship-driven stories lack substance, which is which is sexist, and I object to that. But I really try not to get into that dialogue, you know, because I think, you know, I focus, I'm not in marketing and I write books. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm going to go and edit your Wikipedia myself.
Take it off.
It says women's fiction.
Well, the other thing, you know, kind of tying back to the movies, and you know, I think that you have romantic comedies that are insipid and dull, and they don't have developed characters, and you know what's going to happen within the first 5 minutes, and there's, you know, everyone's an extreme, you know, black, she's good, she's bad, she's this, there's all types, and I don't enjoy those movies. But you're talking When Harry Met Sally, you know, some of the my very favorite movies are really, you know, interesting, layered, relationship-driven, you know, romantic comedies. And so I think that's how I like to think of my books, is sort of, I hope that they're more, they're the substantive version of the romantic comedies that men and women love and that people love, because they're about relationships and they're about people and they have those layers. So.
Speaking of men and women, what are your fans like? What is your fan base like? Like, who is the audience that you're writing for?
You know, it's hard to say, because the people who come out typically to some of my events skew younger, because, you know, if you when you're sort of in your older, having a family or beyond that, you might not be coming to some of these events. So that's hard to say. And Facebook, again, it's a different crowd than people who might be reading it. You know, I think that I've read from Random House, again, that's a, like a marketing thing that I, you know, it's typically like 30s and, you know, anywhere from the 20s to the 50s. I mean, it's very broad. It's it's women, though. It is women.
Sure, do you keep someone in mind, like an audience, when you're writing your books?
I don't.
No?
Kind of going back to the same thing. I try not to be too strategic. You know, I don't think about that too much.
As you're going through the writing process and you're working on a book and you're working on the story and developing the characters and all that, who do you trust to give help you mm-hmm. when you need a gut check? Or right, when you need someone to, am I going down the right road? What do you think about this? Do you have a group of folks? Is that your husband? Is that friends?
Well, I have the same group when I was writing Something Borrowed. I mm-hmm. read my work chapter by chapter, which I think is somewhat unusual, but it's my best friend, my mother, and my sister. And they're very, my mother's a retired librarian. Mm-hmm. She's the reason that I'm a reader and a writer. She cultivated that in me at a very young age. Mm-hmm. She reads more than anyone I know, very across the board, genres. She's just, mm-hmm. and so I trust her in a way. And then my, in certain ways, is like sort of a reader of fiction, mm-hmm. and my sister and my best friend are very different. And in fact, they often have violently different feelings about characters. And like, you better not have this happen. And then my sister will say the exact opposite. So, but I share it with them just because they're two very different voices. And you know, I like to get their opinions.
And so they read it chapter by chapter.
They
and
do.
Help give you feedback?
That's what kind of what I've always done. Like, I'll send a chapter, or like, you know, not necessarily chapter by chapter, but chunks.
Sure.
As we go, and I like getting that feedback from them. Yeah. And it, for me, it builds confidence as I mm-hmm. work my way through to reach the stage where I send it to my editor.
Yeah.
And then my husband, he isn't a big reader of fiction, but I do think he's pretty good at, mm-hmm. at a broad read. He's also finds the little things, like he's like, you know, there was someone on a red eye and they looked down at Greenland and he's like, she's on a red eye, be pitch black. I'm like, great catch, honey. So he's extremely, he's so supportive and he wrote congratulations like last night, I'm so proud of you. And I said to him, and it's true, like we both know I wouldn't be able to do this without
him.
It's such a partnership, mm-hmm. marriage.
Yeah, yeah,
in general,
it absolutely is.
So
this is your seventh book, and as we've mentioned a couple times, debuting number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So what's next for you? What's coming up next? Do you have a pile of other stories that you need to get through and tell? Do you have plans? How does that happen? And what do you see coming up next for Emily Giffen?
Well, I have, I want to finish the script for Something Blue. So that's mm-hmm. next up. I'm about 2/3 of the way finished. So mm-hmm. that'll be the first thing. When I finish my tour, and I'll take, a week off and do nothing and just hang with my kids, my husband. But after that, I'll finish Something Blue, and then mm-hmm. I'll start writing my next book. And I don't know exactly what I'm writing yet, but mm-hmm. I have little ideas of this world that's interesting, or this mm-hmm. idea, and I just question of sort of sitting down and really figuring out my premise and those first few characters. And I always get a baby name book out. I love naming my characters.
That's
the most
how fun.
It's so fun.
Yeah.
This one was the first time I've changed a name. Because mm-hmm. Shay, I knew I wanted like a one-syllable sort of gender-neutral name, mm-hmm. but she used to be Drew. And then I spoke to a sales group at Random House, and I realized that I have a little bit of a stutter, and I stuttered every time I said Drew. And it's like, I've got to change her name. This is terrible. And so recently I was at a book talk, and I said, mm-hmm. I called her Drew, and my publicist was like, Shay. I'm like, all right. She changed her name. So
I want to know more about Astrid another time, too.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think it's time for questions from the audience.
That would be great.
Shall we
I'd
do that?
I'd love to hear from you.
We got a microphone back there and a microphone over there, too. All right, we've got one right here.
Out of all your books, do you have a favorite character?
I mean, probably, that's hard. Probably, I don't know. I'm very attracted to Conrad from Where We Belong, I have to say. I like him a lot, mm-hmm. but Darcy and Ethan I have a sentimental spot for, and as I mentioned, I feel a kindred something with Shay in this book, mm-hmm. so. Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. Here we go.
You became a lawyer, and I'm curious, what caused that to happen.
Yes. Are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not a lawyer, but I just find it fascinating that, you know.
Here's the thing about lawyers, and this is why you know so many lawyers who are doing other things now, because if you knew what you wanted to do, you would have gone to business school or medical school. But instead, you're sort of this liberal arts catch-all who wants to achieve, but you don't know what you want to achieve. So you just go to law school so that you can feel good that you've achieved something. I think that's why so many lawyers leave, because it's not really what they wanted to do. They just did it. And that's sort of why I did it. Because when it came right down to it and the final analysis, I knew I wanted to write creatively, but I was scared, because I thought, well, I don't want to graduate from college, starts this endeavor and instantly fail, then what will I do? Where's my safety net? And in some ways, I think that was a smart, you know, thing to do. And that's why when people say to me, should I not go to law school? I'm like, you can't say that. I don't regret going to law school. It enabled me to move to New York City. I might not have done that otherwise. New York really shaped my fiction early on. But I think the important thing is to just make sure, you know, just do a reality check at various points in your life and say, am I happy now? And I was unhappy my first day as a lawyer.
Did you take a lot of classes on journalism and fine arts or literature?
Well, did I in undergrad?
Yeah, in undergrad, yeah.
No, I really didn't. I was an English history major, English minor. You know what? I'm so sad about Maya Angelou. She was taught at Wake Forest, but I didn't get into her class. I tried.
Oh, she taught when you were there.
I mean,
oh,
she just taught. You know, it was really hard.
Sure.
To get into her, you know, but I never took her. But so, no. And journalism was never. I mean, I was the editor in chief of my. I was editor in chief too.
Yeah, we have something.
But my high school paper. So I liked journalism in high school, but it wasn't ever really. You know, I didn't want to do that. That I wanted the creative writing thing. Although I did consider sports journalism, which was fun to give Shay that job.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't regret law school.
A question over here.
There was a question about what comes next. What's the next book? What's the next thing you're going to do? Is there ever going to be a time when you've told all the stories you want to tell, or you're done with the 50 hours a week?
Yeah.
Or you feel like you're going to stop by your head, or is there a retirement for an author, or is it once a writer, always a writer?
I think one of the great things about being an author is that you don't, you know, you can do it, you know, like think about Tim Duncan, he's retiring, you know, soon here, and his great passion is basketball, and, you know, I can be like a little old lady in a rocking chair and still write stories, and I hope that... That's the case. I hope that I keep, you know, it's sometimes, of course, with any job, no matter how passionate you are about it, you yearn for the retirement, but that's so far off for me, and I hope that I'll always write a story, and I hope that they just continue to evolve and reflect, you know, the changes in me. So, well, thank you.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thank you all for coming.
You guys are awesome.
Thank you, Emily.
I appreciate it.
That was novelist Emily Giffen at the National Writers Series, talking with Stephanie Murray. Giffen's latest book, The One and Only, debuted at number one on the New York Times bestsellers list for fiction. Next time on the broadcast, Daniel James Brown, a best-selling writer of narrative nonfiction. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.